Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Coming to you once again from Arlington, Texas, today with episode 513 of the Survival Podcast. It is a Monday, 9/20/10. Yes, that's right. It's September 20th, 2010. September is almost in the books, folks. Winter is coming. It is time to prepare. And we're going to prepare today by talking to you guys about the things that you think are important, that you've been emailing me like crazy. Again, if you've sent me an email for a show and I'm not answered it, please understand. Please understand. There is no way I can answer them all now. I try to answer the ones that come in, not just from one person, but 10 people. That's how I try to prioritize it at this point. Email in general. If you send me an email and didn't get a response, I do what I can. I really do. I try to interact with you guys as much as I can, in as many ways as I can. And it's just impossible to answer them all, but I do try to read them all. But today we are going to talk about your questions. I've got some interesting stuff. New superbug running through the United States. Not really running, but it's here. I told you about it before, and now it's here. We're going to talk about people that want to know about investing in the Iraqi dinar. That's the Iraqi dollar. And some other things. Follow-up from a show I did last week about earthworm homes and the people that actually build the ones. A little bit on wood gasification from a listener. A successful lawsuit giving Monsanto the beatdown. So that's part of why I'm in a good mood today, and a bunch of other stuff. Before we do that, though, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you and make sure this show is here for you 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. Sponsor of the day number one is the Berkey Guy, with Berkey Light Water Filtration Systems, available at directive21.com. That's the word directive, followed by the numbers 21.com. Berkey provides some of the best equipment out there for water filtration. Absolutely top-notch water filtration equipment. The Berkey Guy is one of their best distributors, one of their top distributors in the nation, and there's a reason. It's not because he spends more money than everybody else with advertising and marketing. It's because he takes care of people, and they come back to him again and again and again, and they recommend him to friends, and that's why we're glad to have him as a sponsor. If you're comfortable drinking the water out of your faucet, don't let me change your mind about that. That's up to you. I'm not. I don't like the water that comes out of my faucet the way it comes out of my faucet. And I also am of the understanding that there may be times that I would beg for that water out of that faucet when I have more pressing needs for water purification. And Berkey can help you with both of them. So check out the Berkey Guy at directive21.com. Next up today is Safe Castle Royal, one of the longest-term sponsors that we had, been with us for a very long time. Gives away a free discount membership to every member of the Member Support Brigade, and they're doing something special this month. We just had a sponsor run 25% off Mountain House. It ran out. Well, guess what? Now here's 25% off Mountain House from another sponsor. Through the rest of the month, you can get 25% off all Mountain House items at Safe Castle. You can also win some cool free prizes if you are a member of their discount club. And remember, if you're a Member Support Brigade member, you get that discount club membership free. But it's a great sale, a plethora of Mountain House items to choose from. So get on over there and consider stocking up in September with that discount. Next up, remember, connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Those are the three big ones. I try to talk to you guys however you guys want to be spoken to, through whatever medium you guys want to talk to me at. And there's about 5,000 of you that want to talk to me on Facebook. So, hey, I'm a Facebook fan, whether I want to be one or not, because you guys deserve it. And it has turned out to be pretty cool. I was kind of drug-kicking and screaming there, but it's been kind of neat. YouTube, I just put a really cool set of videos out last week for Thursday's show, since there was no Thursday show, on my garden. I got a lot of new stuff planned, and now that it's not 187,000 degrees outside, and I don't get like through the first scene, and I'm covered with sweat and wishing to God I wasn't outside, it's time to do some more video. Not that I can't take it, it's just, hey, I'm a big guy to begin with. When I'm all sweaty, I know I'm not really appealing on camera. So more YouTube videos coming, lots of them in the coming weeks, so make sure you're a YouTube subscriber. Remember, we're doing a special show for episode 550. Call 866-65-THINK. Tell me what the Survival Podcast has meant to you, and you could be on the show. If you want an example of what that should be like, listen to the one-year anniversary show. Link in today's show notes. Last but not least, consider joining the Member Support Brigade. Do that. You get exclusive content available only to members. And the discount code that I was running through the weekend, BOL, turns out I did not set it to expire until the end of today. I'm not going to change it. You can still use that. $15 off your first year of MSB expires today with discount code BOL. All right, with that, let's go ahead and get into the main topic of today's show. The first question's an interesting one. Comes from a guy named Eric. Eric says, long-time listener question. What do you think about the investment potential of the new Iraqi dinar or dollar? The Kuwait dinar has buying power of 3-1 on the U.S. dollar. Iraq is a mess, but what is your opinion knowing that money is not on the Forex yet? And the Forex is the foreign exchange stock market, basically, where you can just trade money, right? So Forex lets you do with currency what you do with stock. I can buy, you know, Japanese currency in the morning and sell it and turn it into Indian currency in the afternoon and then sell it back to dollars in the evening. That's what Forex is. And there's a lot of people that they spend all their time doing nothing but Forex trading. So that's what he means when he talks about that. I don't mess with Forex trading. Just wanted you to know what he's talking about. The dinar is not yet on the Forex. You can buy an awful lot of dinars for a few dollars. If you wanted to buy some Iraqi currency and just stick it somewhere as a novelty, I would say fine. If you said, hey, look, I believe in the long-term future stability of a new fiat currency over an old fiat currency, and I'm going to take $10,000 and turn it into however many billion dinars I can get for it and put that in a safe, what do you think? I'd tell you, hell no, hell no, hell no, hell no, don't do it. Iraq is a mess, and it is also a nation that we don't really have an interest in building up into a financial superstar the way a nation like Kuwait is. There's a reason the Kuwaiti dollar trades at a 3-1 ratio over the U.S. dollar. And a big part of it is they have as much oil or more oil than nations like Iraq. And they have this little tiny nation with this little tiny population. So they have extreme wealth relative to the number of the people in the population, and I wouldn't bet on that currency right now because we don't know what oil's going to do. We don't know how much oil they really have. We don't know how much of a mess the Middle East is going to turn into from here. We know that our nation, despite some individuals that are very well-meaning and some individuals that I think are very, you know, maliciously meaning, no matter how hard we try when we do try to do the right thing, we have not been a force of stability in the Middle East. We have not made things better. It has not made anything more stable than it was in the past. In some places, things are much better. I think that the Iraqi people today are better off than they were under Saddam Hussein. That is definitely for sure. But I don't know that the nation, from a pure investment standpoint, is more stable. We have rising tensions with Iran. We have an unfinished war in Afghanistan. No, don't put your money there. Again, if you wanted to buy a couple $100 worth just on a dice roll type thing, like going to Vegas and throwing $200 on double zeros, and if it comes up, it comes up, and if it doesn't, it was your $200 to blow, fine. But this is not an investment. Don't do it. Don't do it with any sizable amount of currency. And even if it was $200, I'd rather tell you to buy $200 worth of silver. You're much better off putting your money into a stable precious metal than something like, you know, a dice roll on the Iraqi dinar. Just not something I would do. Let's say that it even doubled in value over 5 years. I mean, you could go buy a pretty good bond that's very secure and get that out of it. You know, I mean, it's, 5 to 7 year double period on like 7% interest on a, you know, grade A corporate bond would be safer than an Iraqi dinar, in my opinion. You also, if you're hedging against this nation screwing up, this nation is literally holding the Iraqi nation up right now. So if we start to fall apart, then the people we're holding up fall apart at an even greater rate. And I think that's where we're at now. And even when we eventually have all troops out of Iraq, which didn't happen yet and won't happen until August of 2011, as was announced by former President George Bush in September of 2008, as though anything new has happened, folks. Even though when that happens, the amount of money and corporate influence the United States has put into Iraq is holding that nation up right now. And you can think it's good, you can think it's bad. I'm talking, again, as an investor here, I'm not putting my money there. If my fear is that this economy is going to fall, I would much prefer to put my money into, if I'm going to go to a foreign currency right now, I'm going to go into a currency that's not playing stupid leverage games with debt, that's being very smart, that has a history of good performance. I'm not looking so much for increasing my money, but protecting my money, and I'm going to look somewhere like Switzerland. And I know that's the old, that's what everybody says, but if you want a safe place for money, putting it into Swiss currency is not a bad place for it right now. I wouldn't hesitate to put a little bit of money into Chinese currency. I know some people would say, well, you know, they pegged it a dollar, blah, 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 but, you know, it's probably not a bad idea for a little bit of money. If you're looking at full diversification, you're saying, I want to put, you know, 10% of my money into foreign currencies and I want to go with five currencies and 2% into each, the Chinese currency and Swiss currency would be two that I would definitely look at doing. I'm not hip on Russia right now with their currency. I think they got a lot of problems of their own that we're not seeing yet. Brazil, long term, yes. Short term, not sure. That's just where I am with it right now. Let's go on to another question. Thanks for that one, Eric. This one comes from Richard. Richard sends me an email, says Cuba is becoming more capitalist than America. I don't know about quite that, but it is getting better, apparently, for Cubans and a little bit more freedom. Barbers are going to be free. Do you know in Cuba up until like now, if you were a barber in Cuba, you were an employee of the state? Yep, you were employed by the state, and the customer was paying the state, and the state was paying you. Because, see, people have a right to a haircut. They have a right to a barber, and they should be able to go get their haircut for an affordable price at all times. And the only way to do that is to make sure that no greedy barbers take all the money away from the poor people and have the state own, you know, the barbershops. I'm not being sarcastic in reality, because that's what they did. And that's the only way I could see it being justified. That had to be what, you know, Fidel was thinking. But we have a new Castro now, and he's a little bit more open-minded. Let me read a little bit of this article to you. Again, Richard sent us this. It says, Havana, Cuba. Cuba announced Monday it would lay off at least 500,000 state workers. That's 500,000 state workers. In the next 6 months and simultaneously allow more jobs to be created in the private sector as their socialist economy struggles to get back on its feet. The plan announced in state media confirms President Raul Castro is following through on his pledge to shed some 1 million state jobs, a full fifth of the official workforce, but in a shorter time frame than initially anticipated. Our state cannot and should not continue maintaining companies, productive entities, and services with inflated payrolls and losses that damage our economy and result in counterproductive, create bad health habits, and distort workers' conduct, the CTC, Cuba official labor union, said in newspapers. Castro had announced layoffs in August, but said it would occur over the next 5 years. At the time, he said government agreed to broaden the exercise of self-employment and its use as another alternative for employment to those excess workers. The drastic, unprecedented economic changes have many Cubans worried about the jobs that have taken for granted under the communist government will no longer be guaranteed. You'll be allowed to fail in Cuba. Isn't that great? Others are hopeful they will have more freedom to set prices and earn more than the average state wage of $20 a month in the socialist utopia that used to be Cuba. You could make $20 a month as a state employee, but you are guaranteed to keep your job. The state currently controls more than 90% of the economy, running everything from ice cream parlors and gas stations to factories and scientific laboratories. Traditionally independent professions such as carpenters, plumbers, and shoe repairmen are also employed by the state. All right, I'm going to stop there. You can read the rest of the article if you want to. I'll place a link in today's show notes. But in some instances, Richard is actually very correct when he says more capitalists than America, when we have a state official saying our state cannot and should not continue maintaining companies, productive entities, and services with inflated payrolls and losses that damage our economy and result in counterproductive, create bad habits, and distort workers' conduct. Where our country is doing everything it seemingly can to pull as much of our economy as possible into government control rather than private control. Cuba, this little bitty island, if anybody should be able to pull off socialism, Cuba should be able to do it. Really, they should. Okay, they have, you know, great cigars. We won't buy them here in America, but they can send them all over the world. They have a major export crop there. They have actually very fertile farmland, and they're able to grow a lot of their own food. They have a highly independent, self-sufficient people. If everybody can share and share alike, and everybody can get along, and everybody can help each other out, and they can make socialism work anywhere in the world, it should be Cuba. And yet, it has been a failed experiment. And it has not been a failed experiment the way people have tried to say that capitalism has been a failed experiment, because what has failed in the Western world isn't capitalism, it's pseudo-capitalism under fascist control. And I know some people have trouble with fascism. You just look up fascist economics. I can't go into that today and keep rolling through the show, but it has nothing to do with Nazis and Hitler. Mussolini was a fascist. He didn't have, you know, camps exterminating people. Fascism is an economic system, and that's what we have in the United States today, a fascist form of capitalism. Cuba, though, has seemed to figure this out. Like, paying people $20 a month but guaranteeing them a job doesn't really work, and they have what they consider an inflated wage problem. I don't think they have an inflated wage problem. I think they have a depressed wage problem, but the nation's so screwed up it looks inflated right now. So it maybe it's expensive to get your hair cut for 50 cents, but if you only make $20 a month, it's a lot of money. And things like that. And what'll happen in Cuba, I don't know. I'm interested to see. But I am encouraged by what I see here. And I do know for a fact that Fidel Castro was very, very angry at the Soviet Union for the way they went to capitalism and left satellite, you know, territories like Cuba hanging out to dry. He had a much greater admiration for the way the Chinese did things. And I know this from reading a book called Where Have All the Leaders Gone by Lee Iacocca, where he talks about going down and meeting with Castro 15, 20 years ago. And Castro basically saying at that time he was willing to play ball and resume relations with U.S. governments and start doing some of this stuff back then. And our government told him to go screw. Now, if you say that's not true, if that didn't happen, then Lee Iacocca is a liar. And he put his lies in print. Go read his book or get the audio version and check out Where Have All the Leaders Gone by Lee Iacocca. An interesting read for the Cuba stuff alone. Some of his politics in there, obviously, he's more liberal than I am. But I do appreciate the man's worldview. So that might be something to go look at. But interesting that Cuba's doing this now at a time when the U.S. is on a completely different course. Next email comes to me from a person named Jason. Jason says, "Hi, Jack. I'm 21, single. I inherited a few acres from my grandmother who passed away a couple of years ago. I currently live about 15 minutes away from the property with my folks, which is nice, but I want to get the heck out of their house." And you're 21 and get out. You should. All right? Seriously, if you're 21 and you're still living at home and you don't at least have a plan to get your ass independent, let Jack Spear go kick you in the ass right now, young man. You don't need to be languishing at home. You will not advance in your life until you go out and start to have to claim things for yourself. So I'm glad you're thinking that way. The land is where I grew up, and it's very well taken care of by my grandparents. It's largely out of the way. It's great for growing things. Unfortunately, the house that's on it is beyond repair and falling down. I eventually want to turn the land into a primary residence, but I don't have a huge income. However, the place is dear to me, and I hate to see it just sit. Do you have any suggestions for a young guy regarding first steps in making a piece of land into a home? Maybe suggestions for a cheap do-it-yourself type residence. Jason." Okay, Jason, here's the thing. Drive a car that's a piece of crap for the next 5 years, and instead of having a car payment, have an RV or a mobile home payment for 5 years, and own the damn thing outright in 5 years. You probably buy something for around $20,000 to $30,000 that'll make your payment on it a few hundred bucks. Since you already own the land, the property taxes are going to probably be next to nothing. Use the, you know, get an electrician out there to hook it up to you and move the hell out and start building something for yourself. Hire a guy, if the house is beyond repair, hire a guy with a bulldozer to come in and level that sucker. You know, maybe what you do, I mean, it's not the best time in the world to be in construction, but, you know, if you have the time, maybe you start working for some construction companies. Maybe you work for them for next to nothing, for minimum wage or for free as an apprentice to learn. You do it on weekends or after hours or what have you. Say, I'll come in and help you. I just want to learn how to do these things. And maybe you start building a house a little bit out of the time while you live in a little RV or something like that with everything you need as a 21-year-old dude. And maybe by the time you're 25, 26, 27, you have this house built and it's fully paid for. And maybe you have $50,000 into it, which seems like a lot of money when you're 21 and broke. But let's see, $50,000 over 5 years is $10,000 a year. You can work at, you know, Walmart and make 20. And you can put, you'll pay almost no taxes except your Social Security. That's going to cost you $3,000. That leaves you 17. You're making enough, low enough income that you're not going to pay the feds any money. That leaves you $7,000 a year to feed yourself. Boy, you're not going to live real good, but 5 years later, you have a house paid for and built. That's just one way you could do it. It's up to you. I'm being a little bit hard on you because I see reflections of my own son in you, and sometimes I have a need to kick a little ass, you know, but seriously, I think you have a great opportunity here, and there's so many things that you could do. Don't put a tent up and live in a tent. That's not a way to go, but right now, dude, there are so many RVs for sale. Big ones, 32-footers, and if you're not dragging it around all the time, you don't even need a truck, right? Because you don't need this thing to go on vacation down to the coast with or something, right? You need it to sit there. You need it plugged in. So you go see an electrician. You ask him, hey, I need a 50-amp circuit put in on this the existing electric there. You phone up the electric company, make sure service is turned back on. You go find your RV. You hire a buddy with a big truck to drag the sucker over there. You set it up as stable as you can be. You get some wood pallets and put a little deck in front of it to keep from tracking mud in it. And start living, man. Start living. That's it. That's the whole thing. You can do that for $10,000 right now. And you might not have a big income, but you can probably get a loan. If my kid came to me with this and said, will you co-sign on a loan for $10,000, I'd do it. I'd probably loan him the money. I'd probably make him go get a loan and I'd co-sign for him. This is something I would do debt for. Because you can either pay the same money I'm paying this thing off in a year or two, right? Or you can pay the money in rent to an apartment. And at least you have something. And it's mobile and you could go somewhere with it if you wanted to. But this is why I'm big on do it now, get something and get there. The land, even though it's well maintained, isn't going to stay that way if there's nobody taking care of it. And if your grandparents are gone now, someone needs to start taking care of it. The other thing is, you need to start doing something with it. You have an awesome opportunity to build, you know, a food forest. And you're young, so by the time you're like 31, 32 years old, it could be a food for real. You're not going to do that if you're not there. If you take this opportunity right now and you skimp and you save and you work and you do what you can and you build a little house that becomes a big house, you'll build something, you'll die in that house. And I mean that in a very, very positive way. See, Americans have stopped dying in their homes. We buy a house, and then we buy another house, and 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 we buy another house. And we rip our kids from home to home to home, and we're always moving up, and we're always flipping it and getting a profit and moving to the next big house. And then we become old people in a great big house we can't take care of, that we don't really understand because we didn't create the home. We just moved into it in our 50s, you know, that last move, or our late 40s. And now we're 65, and we've got some equity in it. And we want to retire, and we don't really want to take care of this big house, so we sell it, and we move into a condominium or something like that, and we die there. And a lot of us, you know, we get really sick, and then we end up dying in an old folks' home or something like that. I think Americans need to go back to, like, trying to find, as young as possible, the place we want to die and live there our entire lives. Why live the best years of your life somewhere you don't really want to be? This place you already have an emotional connection to as well. Go build something out of it. Do it. I mean, that's the Nike phrase fits right here. Just do it. It ain't that hard. Go buy a $1,000 mobile home if you have to. Who are you trying to impress? You know? Put all the money into the initial construction on building yourself something decent. Start small. Be your own general contractor. Go do some work. Don't try to do the house part now. Go out and do some work for some people that build houses. There's still people building things. You know, if you have a regular job, find your off time. Make it available. Go out there and talk to a couple foremen and say, look, man, I just want to learn. I'll work for next to nothing. You might find a good job that way. I mean, I don't know. You don't tell me what you do here and whether you're in school or not or what have you. But, man, I wouldn't let this opportunity go by. And I wouldn't wait another second. I would get on right now doing whatever you need to do. If it's out picking up aluminum cans and returnable bottles to afford to be able to at least provide electricity and go out and get myself something to live in, tow it out there, plug it in, and I would turn that into my home and I would start right now. That's what I would do. Let's go ahead and take another question. Okay, this one also comes from a fellow named Eric, but a different Eric than the first one. And an Eric that sends me a lot of really great stuff. So you know who you are, Eric. Thanks a lot. But this one came from probably, I got 50 of these in the past week. Because we have talked about it before. And it's about this new virus. And it's not just a virus. It's a potential for many. It's actually not a virus, though. It's a bacteria. And it's a potential for many bacteria to mutate this way. We talked about this a long time ago, a couple months. It was in India and I think it was in China at the time. And those were the only two places. And I said, this will be in the United States. And pretty much the article said the same thing. And I said, this will come here and it will start out small and it will get bigger and it's going to be a real problem. It's not going to be something like a flu, a viral air-to-air transmission thing that's going to be killing people off left and right or something like that. It's going to be something that's going to make it dangerous, more dangerous than it already is to go to the hospital. And it's going to start taking a lot of people that are sick from one thing and getting infected with these secondary infections, and it's going to lead to a lot of mortality. And it's a big problem, and it's a reason to be prepared to take care of yourself and to not run to the hospital every time you're sick. And, of course, I got a couple of emails telling me how I was crazy, that, you know, I didn't know how terrible the Indian medical system was, and my typical daily rash of hate mail that I get. Well, you know, there's those things that you say, well, I was right, but I didn't want to be. This is one of those. This came from September 13th, so it's a few weeks ago. Boston, this is off the AP, Associated Press. Boston, an infectious disease nightmare is unfolding. Bacteria that have been made resistant to nearly all antibiotics by an alarming new gene have sickened people in three states and are popping up all over the world, health officials reported Monday. Oh, great. Isn't this wonderful? U.S. cases and two others in Canada all involve people who had recently received medical care in India. See, Jack, they went to India, where the problem is widespread. A British medical journal revealed that the risk last month in an article describing dozens of cases in Britain and people who had gone to India for medical procedures. So these are people, by the way, folks, who were going for, like, cosmetic surgery and other things where it was very expensive to do in England because they have that great socialized medicine, right? So it was cheaper to do it in India. So they went to India to pay for something at a better cost and come back to Britain and brought it back with them. How many deaths the gene may have caused is unknown. There is no central tracking of such cases. So far, the gene has mostly been found in bacteria that cause gut and urinary infections. If you don't know, a gut infection is one of the worst things in the world you could possibly be infected with. It's very difficult to deal with once you have infections in your lower intestinal tract. Scientists have long feared this, a very adaptable gene that hitches onto many types of common germs and confers broad drug resistance, creating dangerous superbugs. So this is the big part I want you to understand. This is not a single bacteria that mutated. This is a gene that is able to actually mutate and move from one bacteria to another of totally different type. And it makes different types of bacteria drug resistant. I mean, that's like the kind of crap that you write science fiction, horror, medical novels about. So it's not just trying to find a way to stop bacteria A when it's been, you know, it's combined with this gene. But bacteria B, bacteria C, D, E, F, G, you know, and by the way, A1, A2, A3, A4, A5, A6, because there's all these different strains of this stuff and this constant mutation. It's a great concern because the drug resistance has been rising and few new antibiotics are in development. Director of Infectious Disease University, Mark Lindsay, says, it's just a matter of time until the gene spreads more widely, person to person, he said. Grayson heads an American Society for Microbiology conference in Boston, which was buzzing with reports of this gene called NDM1 and named for New Delhi as the ND. The U.S. cases occurring this year from people from California, Massachusetts, and Illinois, said Brandy Lombardo, lab chief at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. These types of bacteria were involved, all three, and three different mechanisms let the gene become part of them. Three cases in three states with three different processes by which the gene attached itself to an underlying bacteria. We want physicians to look for it, especially in patients who have traveled recently to India or Pakistan, she said. What can people do? Don't add to the drug resistance problem, experts say. Don't pressure your doctors for antibiotics if they say they aren't needed. Use the ones you are given properly and try to avoid infections by washing your hands. Let me tell you what wash your hands means. We heard it enough during the flu scare. Wash your hands means we don't know what the hell to do. We got to tell you something, so wash your hands. It's still good advice, but I'm telling you, this is only a matter of time before the politicians pick this up, and we're going to have everybody from the president down coming out and telling us to wash our hands like we're in freaking kindergarten. This gene is carried by a bacteria that can spread hand to mouth, which makes good hygiene very important. So that is a great, this is actually probably a better reason to wash your hands for this than even something like the flu. It is also why health officials are so concerned about where the threat is coming from, said Dr. Patrice Nordam, a microbiology professor at South Paris Medical School. India is an overpopulated country that overuses antibiotics and has widespread diarrhea disease. I don't know how to say diarrheal, whatever it is, and many people without clean water. The ingredients there for widespread transmission, he says, is going to spread all by plane all over the world. So that's what I was saying. Not that these people were wrong about how bad the conditions in India are, but since people leave India and bring this crap with them, it's going to spread. This is going to spread everywhere. This is a worldwide pandemic unfolding in front of you right now. Right now. Now, this doesn't mean run out, scream, and go to the ends of the earth and hide. But I'm telling you that right now, this is a real dangerous pandemic with high lethality, somewhat ease of transmission, no good medical treatments to prevent it, that is and will get worse, and even though everybody and their mother wanted to tell you about the swine flu, which was nonsense, no one's really talking about this yet. Pay attention. The U.S. patients were not related. The California woman needed a hospital care after being in a car accident in India. The Illinois man had pre-existing medical problems with a urinary catheter. We know how he got infected. Thank you, India. And is thought to have contracted an infection with the gene while traveling in India. The case from Massachusetts involved a woman from India who had surgery and chemotherapy for cancer there and then traveled to the United States. You see what I'm saying? This thing is dangerous when people go to the hospital for things that aren't necessarily life-threatening. The cancer obviously was. But this is something that you can go in to have your tonsils taken out, and you end up with this crap. Lab tests showed their germs were not killed by types of drugs normally used to treat drug-resistant infections, including the last resort class of antibiotics that physicians go to, Lombardo said. She did not know how the three patients were treated, but all survived. Doctors have tried treating some of these cases with combinations of antibiotics, hoping that they will be more effective than individual ones are. Some have resorted to using polymyxins, antibiotics used in the 1950s and 60s that were unpopular because they can kill your kidneys. Yay! So we're down to a point now where we got to start using drugs that destroy our kidneys to get rid of infections that we made stronger by overuse of antibiotics in the first place. There's another page to this article. It's a three-page article. I read you most of the two pages of the first two pages, but I'll let you read the rest if you want to yourself. My thoughts on this. I keep telling you the pandemic is our number one most likely global threat. I keep telling you that. I keep telling you that it probably won't be a flu. It could be. I'm not going to say it's not going to happen, but it's probably going to be something we never thought of. I tell you about conditions like NIMF. A disease carried by bats in Indonesia that has a lethality rate of over 80% that we didn't even know existed 10 years ago. And it's not that that's going to be the one, it's just if that's out there, what else can be out there? I keep telling you that all these things, all a virus or a bacteria or a mutation needs is one good day. One good day out of a million mutations where it makes the leap. And it can come down on us like Lucifer's hammer. And people say to me, somebody always has been sick. It's always been the way it's been. And I try to remind people, we did have a thing called the Black Death that wiped out a major portion of the Earth's population of human beings all over the planet. Well, we have better hygiene now. And yes, and everything we do, diseases adapt to. There may come a point at some time where your only protection is going to be good sanitation, good nutrition, and isolation. You can't run out with your main battle rifle, militant type survivalist person, and fight bacteria. This is serious. Now, I'm not saying this is the one, right? I'm not saying this is the end all be all. I'm saying, look, man, this is unfolding right before your eyes. Stay in touch with this story. Because when the media comes out with it 6 to 8 months from now, they're going to make it like it just happened. You're going to need to know the truth, and you're going to need to know about misinformation. You're going to need to know how to protect yourself, how bad this will be, and how much effect it'll have on people that don't go to a hospital. I don't know. It may have little to no effect on people that don't go to hospitals or people that aren't in high-density situations. Man, this is another reason kids that are going off to like high school and college and going to be showering together and in locker rooms and all need to learn about hygiene. I mean, I know I made fun of our elected officials for talking, wash your hands. But man, in this situation, this particular type of danger, it's probably one of the best things you can do. But be prepared for one day. For me or someone else to get on the horn with you and say, hey, look, this is real and this is bad and it's time to operate on a low profile and get the hell out of harm's way until this thing rages through, because this is just another indication that it can happen. I know I try to be uplifting. I try to be motivating. We want to live that better life if times get tougher, even if they don't. But sometimes times get tough. And illness and disease and sickness is one of the things that has a huge potential to lay waste to everything, and it's an equalizer. It doesn't care if you're rich or you're poor. It doesn't matter if you own a tenth of an acre or a million acres. If you're infected with something, you're infected with it, and it's up to your body and whatever medicine's available to fight it off. I also want you to think about how something like this, even if it kind of is just an underlying problem, and then we get something like a virus, like a flu, that goes pandemic, where people do have to be hospitalized, how these two events dovetail into each other. How it makes people that should go to the hospital not go to the hospital and stay out in the general population and continue to spread an infection. How it makes people that really did need to go to the hospital die. This is serious. This is another reason to prep. This is a reason to step things up. This is when I tell you 6 months minimum for your long-term food storage is what I would do if I were you. This is the reason why. Because if you can stay clean and safe and away from exposure for that long, you'll get out of the way of most of these things. It's not 100%. It's not foolproof. You could be sitting in the middle of a mountain somewhere, and some way or another, whatever's infecting everybody could get to you, but it sure increases your odds if you can isolate. I'm not an isolationist, but there's a time for isolation. I'm not a killer, but there's a time for killing. You break in my home, you threaten my family, I'll shoot you. Right? This is the same thing. I'm not for just sequestering yourself off away from everybody else, avoiding contact with people. But in a situation with a highly infectious transmittable disease running rampant, it's the time to do it. This isn't that one in of itself. It's what this does and where it goes from here and what happens next and how it affects people that go to hospitals for routine procedures. Instead of getting a staph infection, they get one of these damn things. They get a staph infection infused with this gene and they die. That's what this is about for now. Let's keep an eye on it together. Let's pay attention to this one. If you get anything beyond what we've talked about today, please get that to me. In fact, if you send me that, put in it drug-resistant virus or drug-resistant bacteria or something like that in the subject line. It'll go to the top of my radar because I want to stay on this one too. Depressing enough, though. Let's go ahead and have a different question. Totally different. Let's get out of that mind area for a moment. Question from another Eric, third Eric of the day. unrelated, I believe, to the other two Erics. What is your opinion on crossbows for shit-hit-the-fan scenarios? To me, it seems the reusable nature of the crossbow bolts would have value in a scenario where ammunition has become scarce. Plus, the quiet nature of the weapon would not give away the hunter's position should there be two-legged predators in a shit-hit-the-fan situation. Being as I know next to nothing about crossbows, I'm sure there's numerous advantages and disadvantages I'm not aware of. I'd like to hear your opinion on the crossbow from a prepper standpoint. Thanks for the show. I learn something new every day. Eric. Okay, cool. Well, thanks for the compliment, Eric. Here's the thing about a crossbow. It is not the magic weapon a lot of people think it is. I think a lot of people, especially in states where there's archery hunters, and they are an archery hunter and they've never fired a crossbow, and their state outlaws crossbow hunting, and they see another state where they allow crossbow hunting as archery equipment, and they look at that and they go, man, a crossbow is like having a rifle with an arrow. You know, it's like this laser beam. It's not. A good bow hunter can easily take 40-yard shots. A 40-yard shot with most crossbows is all but impossible for a variety of reasons. The trajectory of the bolt, they call it a bolt, not an arrow in a crossbow, is much more rainbow-like than a good arrow out of a bow due to a lot of things, but part of it is the length, and just making it longer is not going to change things based on the way a crossbow is designed. You just have to trust me with that. The other thing about a crossbow is they are quiet compared to a rifle, but as archery equipment goes, they're noisy. They make a loud thump, a thwank, a recoil, vibration noise. This also limits their range. Even if you could put the bolt where it is designed to go with an animal, you have flight time. We think a lot of times in terms of a bullet. If I have a gun pointed at a deer at 30 yards and she knows to jump just as I'm pulling the trigger, it doesn't matter. That bullet's going to smack home. That bullet travels so fast that the reaction time isn't sufficient to avoid it once discharge is made. If you get, this is with a bow or a crossbow, if you get caught by a deer at 20 yards or more, and sometimes less, but definitely 20 yards or more, and I've seen it happen to people, with the bow back or the crossbow up, and you release that arrow, they will see it, and they will jump over it, or they will hit the ground and let it sail over their back. They don't know it's a bow and arrow. It's not like they've gone into ninja mode, right, with their animal skills, and they're going, there's a guy shooting at me with an arrow. All they know is something's coming at them very quickly, and they're going to get out of the way, right? If you had a big object coming at you, you didn't know what it was, you'd still move. That's how deer work with bows and arrows. Because a crossbow has that noise. At a far enough shot, even though they're not moving out of the way, a deer, specifically any kind of game of that type, is likely to flinch a lot. And they'll move enough in the time between the release and the impact that even if you still hit them, you often hit them in a place you didn't intend, too far forward, too far back. Now you've got a crippled animal. That's another thing that limits the range of a crossbow. A bow's much quieter, so you're less likely to induce that flinch. As far as reusable is a relative term. I have shot deer with a bow where the arrow has passed cleanly through them, and I found it sticking in the ground 10 feet behind where they were standing when I shot them. I've picked the arrow up, I've cleaned it off, I've taken the broadhead off and run the blades over a stone to give it a little bit of an edge back, screwed it back on, put that arrow back in the quiver, and I've shot another deer with it. I've shot deer where the arrow's gone in part way, the deer spins around, snaps the arrow in half. I found the arrows in the ground that have passed through, broken, bent, destroyed. I had one, I shot a deer, it went perfectly through, and the arrow smacked into a tree. It had enough kinetic energy remaining to damage the arrow beyond really using it again. I've had arrows miss and been unrecoverable. I've had arrows pass through animals and kill them, but not find the arrow. So reusable is a relative term. I mean, that's the big takeaway from this. The big thing to do is to have a large supply of shafts or arrows or bolts, no matter what type of archery gear you're using, and reuse when you can. A ultimate solution would be to become proficient at the fabrication of arrows using natural material and using a longbow with lower draw weights where the wooden arrows can stand up to the power of the bow. And that would be a long-term solution. But any of the hybrid kind of in-betweens are okay. Advantages of a crossbow. It might take me a week or two, if you have an aptitude, to teach you to be very proficient with a bow and arrow. It might take me 15 minutes, if you have an aptitude, to teach you to be proficient out to a distance of about 20 yards with a crossbow. If you can shoot a rifle accurately at 20, 25 yards, you'll be able to shoot a crossbow accurately out to about 30 yards the second you pick it up. The learning curve is far diminished with a crossbow. That's a big advantage for people that aren't familiar with the bow. Disadvantage, I already talked about a lot of them. Some other ones are speed of fire. Cocking a crossbow, getting it locked in, putting a bolt and bringing it up takes a relatively long amount of time. A good archer can shoot an arrow, grab one from the quiver, knock it, shoot another one, grab one, knock it, and fire three shots in 5-6 seconds accurately. Even a reasonable archer that doesn't have that ability to just pull and release with an instinctive shot that lines up a sight can pull off, you know, easily a shot every 10 seconds. I mean, if you rush, it might take longer, but if you just practice sustained fire, if you can't fire a shot every 10 seconds with a bow, you're doing something wrong. You know, you're shooting beyond your range of accuracy at that point then, because it's a knock and it's a draw and it's a line and it's a release. So there's definitely a speed advantage to the bow. For a hunter, big advantage with the crossbow is when you're hunting deer or any kind of a game with a bow, it's not so much about, once you're proficient and you can shoot well, fine. So it's not about from the release forward in time. It's up to the point of the release. It's the draw. So you can't sit around in the woods with your bow at full draw in a tree stand waiting for hours and hours and hours for a deer to come, and when one comes, just let go of it. Right? And that's basically how a crossbow works. It's drawn. So a deer is coming, and I can take any point where their head's behind a tree or something, and I can bring that crossbow up to my shoulder, keep my head up high, and I can just freeze, and I can wait for my shot, bring the sights on, and pull the trigger. With a bow, I've got to get the bow up, I've got to get the arrow drawn, and that's a lot of motion. And then I've got to wait out, like if I use the fact that the deer put his head behind a tree and he's walking forward, so I take that point and I draw. And I'm betting on the fact that that deer is going to keep moving and come out from behind that tree. Now, if he happens to pause and waits 10, 15, 20 seconds before he comes out, I've got to sit there with my muscles exerting control over that bow during that whole time. My muscles start to atrophy. They start to shake. My accuracy, my confidence goes down. If I let the draw down on the bow during this period, I'm likely to create noise. I'm more likely to alert the deer to my presence. I'm less likely to be able to get the draw back again. So those are the advantages to the crossbow. The weapon's ready to go. The disadvantage, and easier to learn to shoot. Disadvantage, less range, more potential for noise, more for hunting. It is a pretty silent weapon when it comes to other people knowing your location. But more potential for noise and range reduction and rate of fire. Advantages, easy to learn how to use, highly effective, very accurate within its effective range. Great question. Let's go ahead and take another one. This one comes from Shane. Got off the Eric's for a while here. Says, I've been experimenting with, and this is on gasification. I don't really have a lot to say. I'm just going to give you what this guy sent. I think it's good advice and good information. Hey, Jack, I've been experimenting with gasification for over 3 years and thought I would answer some of your questions on episode 512. I'll keep this as short as possible since I know you receive a lot of emails. Understatement of the year, bud. On the validity, during World War II, large portions of Europe, including most of Scandinavia, used wood gas for transportation fuel. Many cities around the world in the 19th century used wood and or coal to supply street lighting and fuel homes with gas. Today, gasification is in use in industry all over the world, including companies like Sorsol, and creates all of South Africa's liquid fuels from gasifications to liquids via Fischer-Tropsch process, whatever that is, I don't know. The variety of gasifier that works best is dependent on a few factors, such as the size of the fuel source. However, with wood chips, the Imbent gasifier will be the solution for nearly all homes and farm-scale gasification needs. The gasifier is superior to the alternatives due to its tar-breaking capabilities, producing the cleanest fuel gas on a small scale under 100 kilowatts. The cost for a unit shipped to your door ready to run is going to be over $10,000. There are companies manufacturing gasifiers in China that may reduce this cost. I built an ambient gasifier that mimics the technology of these units for under $400 by using scrap steel and doing 100% of the fabrication welding myself. You also asked about how much fuel you can expect to get from a gasifier, and the general rule is, for wood-fueled gasifiers, about 20 pounds of wood will give you the equivalent of 1 gallon of gasoline and energy. Obviously, you'll get different results depending on the quality of the wood and how dry it is. As far as experts to interview, I would first recommend Ben Peterson because he seems to be open to interviews. His website is victorygasworks.com. The leading expert who doesn't seem to do many interviews is Tom Reed at woodgas.com. And you may have some luck getting interviews with members of the GEK crew at gekgasfire.com. I'll put links to all of those places in today's show notes. If you'd like to see one of those folks on the Survival Podcast, why don't you guys, the audience, say, hey, I'd love to see Jack Spierkel on the Survival Podcast interview you and let them know how to get a hold of me. Because if they get it from you guys, it's going to be more likely they're going to want to come on the show for an interview than if I say, hey, come on my show and be interviewed. So a lot of information there. Some of that stuff I don't quite get, but I'm going to do more research into it. But what we're seeing is there is validity to this technology. 10K, I know you can do this for less, but probably not with the exact equipment that this individual, Shane, here is talking about. So I take him at his word that that would be a good setup at that price. But I found some units that run for about $4,000 to $5,000 that I think would be quite effective as well and are easy then to convert a basic normal generator to run off of them. So a lot of stuff with wood gasification, something I'm really considering kind of playing around with long term. And then fabricating one for $400. Entrepreneurs, listen, he made one for $400. They're selling for $10,000. Get off your butt and do something. I bet you if you go out and find a good welding shop, they ain't breakneck speed right now, and come up with your own design on this enough that you don't get in trouble with patents, and start producing something like this, I bet you could produce them for under $1,000 a unit. And I bet you if you produced it and shipped it for $1,500 and sold it for $3,000, you got a pretty damn good business model going. Just saying. And you probably could push costs down from there. That means you push profit up from there. And if you could do it in a situation where it came to people with a generator and everything they needed to basically plug and play it, you might be able to sell some of these. Because there's a lot of wood out there to be gotten rid of. A lot of it. Tons of it. Tons and tons. And 20 pounds equals a gallon of gas. Just in the wood that's thrown away from replaced fences, and all of these subdivisions alone as fences are replaced, there's a tremendous amount of wood gas to be produced and utilized. There's so much opportunity with this. I was a slow convert to it. The more I learn, the better this technology looks. I'm looking to see some entrepreneurs out there figure out how to make this stuff and make it cost less money. Because we figured out how to make the automobile something that could be turned out in the thousands at a time. This is far more simple technology. The economy's down. There's lots of cheap labor out there right now to be had. People will be blessed to have a job. Someone can do something with this if they want to. Another one that comes in, and this is not really a question, but just another bit of feedback from a guy named Aaron, and just something I wanted to share with the audience as well that came in by email. He says, I recently spent 4 days out in the bush with Dave Canterbury, and all I can say is, wow, what an experience. There's a world of difference in surfing the internet forums, reading about primitive skills, and actually getting out there and getting your hands dirty doing it. I grew up in the woods, so a lot of these things aren't unfamiliar to me. But coupled with the lack of food we were subjected to and the time constraints, it was still quite a challenge and a valuable experience. I never had so much fun being tired, wet, and hungry. Like you were saying in your edible weeds episode recently, there's nothing more valuable than going out and getting your hands dirty, practicing your preps. All those armchair survivalists yelling at the TV saying, you're doing it wrong, and get out, you need to get out and experience it before trying to tell people the quote, right way, unquote, to do it. Now, I hope you can forgive the shameless self-promotion here, but I did a pretty extensive write-up of the weekend on my site, OlympicWanderer.com. I think people can get a pretty good feel for what it's like out in the wilderness with not a lot of stuff to rely on. This site is up and running today because of you, by the way. Thanks, Aaron. Aaron, I'm going to link to your review on that on Olympic Wanderer. Let people check it out. I think it's cool that you were out there with Dave. Dave's a great guy, and I love the fact that even though he's Mr. Hollywood now, he's not turned his back on what made him successful. He's still going out there with the everyday common person, doing the everyday common training, and he's not charging twice what he did last year. He's charging the same thing he did a year ago when no one really knew who he was unless they saw him on YouTube. And that says something about the guy. So I'm glad Dave's a friend. I'm glad you got to spend some time with him. And I completely agree. I don't talk a tremendous amount about primitive and wilderness skills on TSP. And the reason is that those skills are so visual. It's hard to do audio on how to make a bow drill fire, all right? So I don't talk about those a lot. I also feel like I've always tried to come into this space and fill what at the time was a completely unserved niche. There was nobody doing anything like I'm doing. Now, there's people now, but when I started, I was the only one really doing a show like this. So since there was so much great material on guns and primitive skills, I talk about primitive skills some and guns some, but I talk more about everyday, real-world survival that you do in your home to ensure your life. But primitive skills are a huge part of that. That's why I've had guests on like Dave, like Ron Hood, to talk about where the two dovetail together. How if you know how to build a fire in the woods, you know how to build a fire in your backyard. If you know how to trap in the wilderness, you know how to trap in your backyard. These are great skills to learn, and it's a great thing that people are out there testing their skills, learning new skills, and working to develop them. So make sure that you take advantage of the opportunities that are available to do things like that. And if you get an opportunity to get out there with Dave Canterbury, do it. Let me tell you, Dave is one of the people that I've met in the industry that I've taken to like he's a long-lost brother. I'd say he and Ron Hood are two that I really have a lot of respect and admiration for and just a personal affinity with. And if you can make time to get out into the wilderness with Dave or Ron, do it. I just had another person email me I won't have on the show today because it came in after I put today's show together. But they were just basically saying they just met Ron at Rabbit Stick and spent time out in the woods with Ron at Rabbit Stick. And they had a very similar feel for the way things were with Ron as they did with Dave. And I think you'll find that with a lot of people in the industry. There's something about when you're genuine as a survival trainer, as a teacher, and you've really looked into the abyss. You've looked into how bad it can get. You've looked at what would happen to me if, for instance, when I'm talking about pandemics, if it hit. Even though I'm prepared, what would it really be like? Or if you're Dave and you put out the video that he had out called Bad Day at the Office, where it took him 9 hours to try to get a fire started and he couldn't do it because it was so wet out. Or Ron with his experience with a mushroom from hell, as he called it, that caused him undue suffering, that he actually videoed and went on record with to say this is what happens. All of those things, the thoughts, the actions, the deeds, the hardships, keep you humble. And I'll tell you, there's no industry in the world that I know of where the people that are considered to be the experts in the industry, and most of them will shudder when you call them an expert. Somebody else is the expert, not me. That's how they all feel. There's no place where those people are more approachable and genuine and humble that I know of than the survival industry. So do get out there and share the wilderness with them when you can. We'll be doing some events going into next year. Get out there with us. We want to be out there with you. If you are members of Ron Hood's forum, he's doing a get-together next month. I'll be there. I'll leave it at that. It's up to you to go from there and find out about it because they have kind of their own rules on their forum about who gets to come. So, but I'll be down there. I think anybody can come, but they want to know who you are before you come, and it's been basically for their members. So it's really for Ron's members. But if you're a member of Ron's forum and you're thinking about going down to the fall gathering, I will be there. Take advantage of these opportunities to spend time with people. And not just to get out in the woods and put some of your own happy suffering, if we're going to call it, just to get to know people, to shake hands with them, and to realize how many of us are out there that we're not alone. Next one comes from Ted. Ted says, a successful lawsuit against Monsanto, its basis is the impact of cross-pollination. And if I could sing, I would do that hallelujah, hallelujah, you know, that thing, because I screamed this for so long. And it already happened a year ago with, or actually 6 months ago with rice. Now it's happening with sugar beets. A federal judge says sugar beet farmers can't plant genetically engineered varieties next year, and those farmers who produce half of America's sugar are now in a bind. Even NPR seems to indirectly lean toward Monsanto side by side, is how I read the article. Let me pull the article up for you real quick, and it's called Sugar Beet Beatdown, Engineered Varieties Banned. Federal judge says sugar beet farmers can't plant genetically engineered varieties next year, and those farmers who produce half of America's sugar are now in a bind. Many of them say they cannot go back to the way they used to work because they don't own the tools anymore and there aren't enough conventional seeds to go around. Gee! What? What? You've become so dependent on Monsanto, that's this benevolent organization trying to save the world, that you can't grow the food you grew 15 years ago anymore? There's not enough seeds to go around? Doesn't this read like another really bad horror novel? Not enough seeds to go around. We're stuck with the Frankenfood. The genetically engineered sugar beets called Roundup Ready beets can survive doses of the herbicide Roundup. That makes it easier for farmers to control weeds. They simply spray Roundup or chemically equivalent herbicides over the fields, and the weeds die while the sugar beets thrive. When sugar beet growers switched to the new varieties two years ago, it's not even 2 years ago, and they can't go back for 2 years. What's going to happen in 20 years, folks, when we realize how bad this crap really is? They did not expect legal problems. Roundup Ready soybeans and corn, approved a decade earlier, cover millions of acres in America's farmland. Those crops have received exactly the same government approval. But in recent years, environmental lawyers such as George Kimbrell, hero of the week, George Kimbrell, senior staff attorney at the Center for Food Safety, have rolled out a new line of legal attacks against genetically engineered foods. The concern is the farmers' loss of their fundamental right to choose the crop of their choice. Kimbrell argues the organic farmer might lose that choice, for instance, if another farmer across the road grows a genetically engineered version of the same crop. When the crops flower, they will cross-pollinate. The organic farmer may have a problem. If you're marketing your product as organic or non-GMO, genetically modified organism, it is, and it's contaminated, you lose your market. You can lose your certification. Can't go back. Kimbrell's group, along with some organic seed producers, sued the U.S. Department of Agriculture, arguing the USDA did not look carefully enough at the potential impact of cross-pollination before it improved genetically modified sugar beets. A federal judge agreed in August. He shocked the sugar beet industry by revoking approval of the beets until the USDA carries out an environmental impact study. That could take a couple of years, so unless there's a new legal twist, farmers will go back to planting conventional beets next spring. I'll leave you to read the rest of it. And NPR does lean toward the poor genetically modified crops. Why do we hate them so much? At least a little bit. Here's the thing, attorneys that chase ambulances, do something productive. This is legal precedent. I think we need to now go sue over corn. Corn is a much greater threat to cross-pollination. Damages can be easily proven in corn. Damages can be easily proven with canola, also known as rapeseed. And I'm liking what I'm seeing here. The whole point is that if I'm Farmer Jack and across the street is Farmer Bob and I'm growing a plant that I do not want genetically modified and I don't want my seed to be genetically modified and I want to save my seed and use it, and Bob across the street wants to do his thing, that's fine until the point where his activities interfere with my ability to act as I choose. Because now his crap's infecting mine. Here's the bad news. Here's the bad news, folks, about this one. If I were working for the defense on this one, I would have a pretty good defense. Beets don't flower their first year. They don't. If you want to save beet seeds, anybody who's done it can tell you what you do. You let the beet in the ground, and it's a biannual crop. Its second year, it sends up seed heads, and it produces flowers, and it produces seeds. So this one probably will be eventually overturned, because as long as the crop is harvested, it's not likely to cause cross-pollination, except they're going to have to guarantee that every single beet has been harvested, every single one. Because if any of the seed during the planting ended up in a bar ditch or something like that, and it grows on its own, it starts to cross-pollinate, and once it's out, it's done, and that's the defense. But those are going to be, that's going to be the key argument here, that even if this is the case, beets are safe under the environmental study, which may take several years to set this thing back some, which is great. At least it's set back. Time for people to, you know, think about this. But that'll be the argument. And that would probably be the results of the study. That as long as it's harvested, it doesn't go to seed and it doesn't infect Farmer Bob, you know, Farmer Jack across the street from Farmer Bob. But the precedent set, corn pollinates for miles. Canola pollinates for miles. One with insect primarily and one with wind primarily. It's a good precedent. But unfortunately, I don't know that people will learn the bigger lesson here. The bigger lesson is people have been doing this for 2 years. In 2 years, we've gone from able to do it with what we had to we can't go back in 2 years. We've been doing it with corn and soy for 10 years. What's it going to look back like if we have to go back? There's not enough seeds available, so the farmers say. We don't have the tools and we don't have enough seed to go back. And the judge says, well, you're going to go back anyway. Figure it out. We need to watch this one too, man. I've said it over and over that we don't know what we're doing here. We're playing with things we should not be playing with. That if something in this activity goes wrong, without having the stockpiles of conventional seed and the knowledge and the materials of how to grow them, and by destroying our farmland, further and every time we engineer the crop to do more with less, we take less care of the dirt underneath it, that we're headed for worldwide famine at some point. Or we're going to be headed to a point where we're going to have to eat the genetically modified food even after it's been proven that it's killing us. Because we're not going to have a choice. I'll put a link to the rest of the article, folks. This is why you need to take some action and grow some of your own food. Here's another great question comes to me, and I'll do the best I can with it. It comes from Thomas. Thomas says, sent you an email about a previous show. Now I have my own question. I'm a police officer, former SWAT operator, counter sniper, and now I'm a chief. I have more than one go bag and always at a dilemma with myself. All my friends, of course, are police officers, most formerly Marine or Army, and all are preppers like myself. So I have attempted to listen closely to their advice about being prepared. For instance, in all my vehicles, there's a small survivalist kit that, if necessary, can live on my own for a few days if needed. Here's my dilemma. In all my experience has taught me, you can't be prepared for everything. You just can't bear that load on yourself. The sheer weight alone of a go-pack that could carry everything you needed or thought you needed would break your back. I know what I need for me, but I have a wife and two daughters now. Ugh. And I ain't as young as I used to be. A man in touch with himself, with who he really is and what his limitations are. And not being all, and even though this guy is a chief of police now, he's been on a SWAT team, he's been a counter sniper, right? And hangs out with all these Marines and Army guys, knows that I just can't be Billy Badass. I gotta take care of my family. This is the message I've tried to send to you guys a lot of times, the ones that have that, I'll just grab my rifle and go to the woods attitude. What do I decide to leave behind? By the way, you're always thanking everyone for their service. I understand you're a vet too. Thank you for your service. Never had the opportunity to serve. My father broke his neck when I was 14 years old, and I had to grow up rather fast after that. Take care of him and my mother. Life would never let me go as it seems. Thank you. So, hey, I say thank you for your service as an officer, because we need people serving here every bit as much as we need them serving somewhere else. And in some ways, I think right now we need them a hell of a lot more right here. And this guy's a good guy, folks. I won't give away his full name because I don't think that would be right. But he is a West Texas guy and a lot of common sense. And he reminds me a lot of an officer that I knew growing up as a kid that really helped my family out in a few situations and was a good guy to the community. So thanks for your service. As far as what you take and what you leave, here's my philosophy with this. I would rather have something and not need it than need it and not have it, as long as it's possible. And what that means is I keep my vehicles well stocked, I keep my home well stocked, I keep my bug out location well stocked, I keep my bags well stocked. And there might be a case where I have to go mobile. And if I have to go mobile and that bag seems too heavy, I might start to jettison some things. I would probably jettison them at the vehicle first. I would base it on the situation. Where am I going? How long is it going to take me to get there? I might carry things for every conceivable need when I'm in a vehicle. But then if I have to go on foot, that you have to think like an operator now, and you're a SWAT operator, so use that training here. I have to think about the mission I have now. Is my mission to go 2 miles and get home where I'm well-stocked? Or is my mission to disappear for 3 weeks? These are two different missions. You know, and anything in between, and I'm going to extremes, a pretty easy one to a pretty tough one. And I'm going to keep the things that are going to be most valuable based on the individual mission. That's what I'm going to take with me when I have to go. I'm going to do everything I can to not lose a vehicle or some type of transportation. I would rather be on a bicycle than on foot. Even if I go to places where I can't ride a bicycle, I can push it and I can use it as a cart to carry things. But it's never going to have a perfect answer. I can't say, well, if you put this kit together, it'll be only 40 pounds and it'll cover everything. You're going to have to think about the individual mission and tailor what you take with you if you go on foot to that mission. The best advice is to do everything you can, though, to not ever put yourself into that position. Never be on foot. Always have reserve fuel. Never let that, you know, your police cruiser or, you know, family sedan go under half a tank. When you see half a tank, the next gas station you see, pull in and fill it up. You're going to spend the money anyway. That's a big one. There are situations where travel is impaired, and that's when you might go on foot. But there's no good, easy, one-off answer to this, other than to understand the limitation, which this guy's already in touch with, and everybody else should be in touch with. I've met people, let me see your bug-out bag, and I got this bag. That's a great bug-out bag, man. I got everything, you know? And I pick it up, and it's 75, 80 pounds. And they say, yeah, I can carry it. They throw it on their back and show me, look, I can carry it. Yeah, how long? How far? Under what conditions? How much is it going to, have you even thought about, like, how waterproof this thing is? How much is it going to weigh if it gets wet? How much weight could water add to it, another 10, 20 pounds, when you're already at a threshold? What's in here? Do you really need all this? And again, it's not, no, I don't need it, but maybe you need to at least have a plan for what's going to come out in a critical situation. What would you give up first? But, the upside, if you keep your vehicle full of fuel, and if you're smart about what you're doing, and if you pay attention to what's going on around you, the odds that you're ever going to have to traverse 20 miles with a pack, unless you're an Army Ranger or something like that, are very, very low. It's just not the way our society works at this time. And it would take a tremendous breakdown for that to occur. The other side of it. If it ever did, you're never going to carry everything you need anyway. If that ever happens, you're going to have to live off the land, whether it's the urban landscape or the rural landscape. So you take the things that are most valuable for the individual situation. And that's what you have to be ready to sacrifice things. Because you're right, you can't take it all. Building a different bag for each mission is impossible. Building a modular system where you have components, a fire kit, you know, a water kit, a medical kit, things like that, in individual pack components where you can actually remove an entire component or remove a component and extract a certain number of things is good sense anyway. But you're never going to take everything with you. That's why it's so important to be able to bug in or to have a place to bug out to that's already pre-stocked. Living the hunter-gatherer lifestyle in the wilderness is only possible with a much smaller population than what we have today. If 10% of this nation right now tried to pull that off, the resources would be stripped almost overnight. We have got to have things in reserve, and we've got to make any kind of bag that we carry, a get-home bag, a bug-out bag, whatever, mission-specific. It has got to be designed to get you from somewhere to somewhere, and you need to know where that to somewhere is. And that's what it's really got to be all about. And if you're ever stuck in that situation with a wife and kids, it compounds the seriousness of the situation. They all need to have a plan of their own to get home or to get to a rally point. And some secondary means of communications is really a great idea. Best I can do for you. It's not ever going to be something I can just give you again an easy answer to. Great question. Again, thank you for your service. And with that, even though I had a couple more queued up, the show went really long. It's over a minute, an hour 12 right now. An hour and 12 minutes right now. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up. I know we talked about some serious stuff today. And even some things I couldn't really give you an answer to. And that's because once in a while we need to do that, because we need to accept the fact that we will never have all the answers. but we can make a difference in our lives and in the lives of those people around us. Just like this gentleman serving our community here as a law enforcement officer, we need to remember survival is not just about us. No matter how tough we think we are, it's about the people we care about. It's about the people we love. It's about making sure that we're prepared to take care of them and that we're prepared for the fact that we're not always going to be as capable as we are today. That time and age and injury is a constant in the world. And we can go from being incredibly fit, incredibly capable today to being dependent on other people tomorrow because our bodies are fragile. Our minds actually are more fragile than we'd like to believe. A lot of these things that we talk about, like drug-resistant bacteria today, they're not pleasant to think about. We have a tendency, even us as survivalists, to put them out of our mind. Because if someone's coming to take my freedom, at least I can fight. I might lose my life in the fight, but at least I can fight. I can see my enemy. But a disease, I can't see it. I can't touch it. I can't fight it. I just have to deal with it. And that's part of survivalism, folks, is being able to just deal with you're not always going to have all the answers. On some level, it's about faith. You have to have enough faith in yourself to know that as long as you do everything you can to prepare, you'll be able to do the best that you can under whatever comes your way. And you have to have enough faith in your fellow man, too. You have to understand that for every idiot out there, there's a counterbalancing good person that means well. You have to look at some of the horrible things that have happened in this nation and realize that most of the people didn't snap out and start stealing and taking from others. They came together and they found strength. And that even though things are quote-unquote different today, the human condition, the human being underneath is the same. And most people want to help others as long as they can. And those two things together should give you hope for our future. Not an overly optimistic, pie-in-the-sky hope, but a hope that if we do the right things, we can all get through it together. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they are.
Nobody up there cares, they're living for today.